In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Action stations.
Aye, aye, sir. Sound the general alarm.
The Chinese pilot insists we're inside their territorial waters and he will fire.
An act of violence.
Torpedo, torpedo, torpedo.
It was an unprovoked attack on a ship in international waters.
The promise of war.
And instead of decisive action, all you want to do is investigate.
My goal is to prevent World War III, Admiral.
Now, the world has only one chance for peace.
When will our ships be in position?
48 hours.
And just one man for the job.
Bond. James Bond.
How much do you know about Elliot Carver, 007?
Worldwide media ban. Most newspapers, radio, satellite TV.
There's no news. Like bad news.
I understand you once had a relationship with Carver's wife.
Was it something I said?
How about the words, I'll be right back?
I'm from the New China News Agency.
Looking for a news story?
You could have taken care of him.
Let the mayhem begin. Your new BMW.
Will you need collision coverage?
Yes.
Property destruction?
Definitely.
Personal injury?
Accidents do happen.
Grow up, 007.
You seem to have developed a certain attachment.
I get to work with a decadent agent of a corrupt Western power.
I think you've found the right decadent, corrupt Western agent as a partner.
Phase 2 is underway.
This holiday season.
What the hell is he doing?
His job. The world belongs to Bond.
When you remove Mr. Bond's heart, there should just be enough time for him to watch it stop beating.
I would have thought watching your TV shows was torture enough.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and this time out, Mr. Sean Whalen was unavailable. And so we brought in the James Bond panel to discuss the next movie on our consecutive streak of James Bond movies, which is Pierce Brosnan's Tomorrow Never Dies from 1997. Now,
you almost said 79 there.
I almost did. Well, because I am
ancient.
I am number dyslexic, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm pretty confident that I saw this in the theater because it's a James Bond movie. But I don't remember seeing it in the movie theater. I do remember seeing it when it first came out on video. And I do not remember seeing it between then and this week when I watched it for this. And quite frankly, I find this to be a really good idea with some really good acting and a forgettable movie that I really didn't care for all that much in the James Bond world. Because I've often said, I'll watch pretty much any James Bond movie and I will enjoy it. And this will fit that bill. But this is definitely on the lower end of my James Bond movies. And I think those are going to be fighting words with some of the people in our panel here.
Who include,
because I have not actually introduced the panel, Chris Tyler, Dan Pescarella, Brian Hughes, Jeffrey Vaughn, and Scott Gardner.
Hey!
So why don't we work our way around and tell me when you first saw it and what you thought of it or think of it, you know, briefly, and then we'll get into details.
Well, I saw this in the theater, and I remember being very excited at the time to see it because Terry Hatcher was in it, and this was on the heels of Lois and Clark, and I had a bit of a thing for Terry Hatcher back then. So I definitely saw this in the movies, and I think at the time that I did like the movie. I mean, I don't hate the movie, but having rewatched it now, it's not as good as I remember.
All right, so you and I aren't going to fight over this then.
Nah, I thought I was going to enjoy it a lot more than I did, and I didn't. Of course, I got aggravated starting because I have that DVD set that I think Scott's got as well with all the Bond movies, and I cracked this one out, put it in the player, and the disc did not work.
Oh.
Tried it in two separate machines, so it wasn't the disc. Everything else plays great. The second one with all the backup stuff, the movie, not so much. And, of course, this was the one movie that is on no platform whatsoever that you have to pay to rent it, which I did because I care about you people.
Now you know.
So I wasn't as thrilled with this one, you know. As we go along, I'll pick you on it later.
Yeah, just quickly, your memory is that you enjoyed it more when you had first seen it?
Yes, I remember enjoying it a lot more the first time I saw it. And like I said, I had it, I want to say I had it on VHS because I was slow to the DVD party and did watch the hell out of it. But this time, not so much.
All right. So, Chris, are you back with us?
I hope so.
So, okay. So pick up with your.
All right. So like I said, I started in the theater twice. Enjoyed it both times. I've watched this one many a time over the last 27 years. God, 27 years. I found it of the time at the time. I still find it of the time, which is frightening. Love Jonathan Pryce in it. Pregnant Terry Hatcher looks great in it. Michelle Yeoh, we'll get to her. I have a blast with this one still. But again, I'm sure opinions are going to vary.
Yeah, we'll talk some details as we go along. Brian, you are next.
Yeah, I saw it in a theater with a large group of friends. I was working at AST Computers and we were just like the mob, you know. We were all into like Jackie Chan at the time. And I had just gotten through my divorce, so I was going out and partying, having fun this year, and I just totally enjoyed myself with it. And another aspect of it was that just a couple years earlier, I walked away from a career in journalism because I felt it was going that way. And so I really loved it back then. And it kind of, you know, watching it again recently, it felt incredibly topical to what's going on in our news media. So I enjoyed it for that, and I enjoyed it for the Michelle Yeoh aspect of it. But I do see the chinks in the armor.
Poor choice of words.
Oh, you know, you've been thinking that. It's just like that scene in Scrubs.
You know, Ron Darling used that expression on a baseball game that he was announcing. He was talking about a pitcher, and he said, you know, the one chink in his armor is that he lacks whatever, and they treated that as if it was a racial slur.
Oh, man.
But anyway, Jeff, you are next on the list.
I saw this movie. It was the last in my streak
of seeing all of them consecutively opening day from The Spy Who Loved Me on. I saw the next one, The World Is Not Enough, the second day. And don't know that I've ever watched it again. But this one I saw opening day, probably saw it again within a week. Definitely loved the angle of the manipulative media. Jonathan Pryce was fantastic, one of the great Bond lines ever in that movie. And Michelle Yeoh carrying on the roller coaster of competency among Bond women that starts with Barbara Bach in Spy Who Loved Me and then goes on up and down and up and down from there until we get a extremely competent woman, great martial arts movie person, but also a great actress. And I really enjoyed it. I think it's Brosnan's second best Bond movie. And I look forward to what everybody hates about it, but it'll be a fun discussion. And this is the part where I got to say that when Michelle Yeoh came to my office, I did notice.
as well, you should have.
She signed our guest book, Bond 18, as her employer.
Nice.
All right, Scott.
She was cool.
I'm sure.
I have a notoriously bad memory, so I've got to think back to when I first saw this. Let me see. It was way back Monday night. Yeah, that's when I saw it. We're recording this on a Thursday. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, Paul. I think I missed the recording for GoldenEye. Is that right?
You did.
So I love the James Bond movies, but I had never seen any of the Brosnan ones. I purposely skipped them because I just don't like him. But I did watch GoldenEye in preparation for our show on it. And then, of course, I didn't make it. But one of the things that surprised me about GoldenEye is I thought that David Arnold's first Bond score was GoldenEye, and I was kind of surprised to find that it wasn't. So it's actually this movie. So that was the thing I was most looking forward to going into this movie was David Arnold's score, because I really like him as a composer. And it didn't disappoint. That was the thing I enjoyed the most about the movie. That said, I found it enjoyable. I didn't dislike the movie, but it, I don't know. It had some issues, which, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about as we go along, but yeah, I didn't dislike it. I would find it, a quick recollection. It's kind of right in slightly higher than like middle of the road Bond for me, but yeah, I enjoyed it. There were a lot of things I liked about it. And then there were some things that, it's not necessarily that I disliked, that I just found like a little weak or a little odd or that sort of thing. But yeah, it was, I mean, I enjoyed it while I was watching it.
I think what I'm going to do is I think I'm going to give you my basic criticisms that come to mind and then let you guys address them and tell me why I'm wrong. Okay. Now I thought all of the acting was fine. I didn't have any problem with the acting. My problems go to, even though I think it's a great idea for a story, the manipulation of the press, and you could probably take that further now and make it the manipulation of the press and social media, if you were going to do that now. I didn't think it was extremely well executed. I thought Jonathan Pryce was wasted because I thought he was, he's an excellent actor giving a really good performance, but never really felt over the top threatening to me. He was always just in the background. There was, even when he was seething, it just kind of didn't feel threatening the way it should have to me. Stamper was probably the most by the book, innocuous henchman I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's weak.
And Scott, you're going to disagree with me, but I thought the score was far too reliant on John Barry's James Bond theme. And didn't really do enough to create moods at all during this movie.
Well,
I thought the score was underwhelming.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. I enjoyed it because I like Arnold, but he got the job, and this is all off of Wikipedia, which, as we know, is, you know, absolutely 100% accurate. So, but I was reading today that he got the job. So they wanted Barry back for this one, and I guess they couldn't work it out. So he suggested Arnold based on an album I don't have, but my impression is it's one of those albums that it's like a jam piece where other artists do themes, you know, somebody else's themes, like almost like a tribute album, or like if it was bands, you know, if we were talking about rock and roll or something, it would be like a cover type of thing. And he did that and impressed Barry with that. So the score very much sounds like what it is, which is kind of like a concert version or like a tribute version to James, you know, to Barry's James Bond, borrowing very, very heavily from Russia with Love. There's a lot of From Russia with Love in this. So yeah, it's good. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't exactly stand on its own. It's more of like James Bond's greatest hits conducted by.
Hang on for just a second. Is the actual Bond theme, you know, the dun 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 dun, that should be saved for moments when he's doing some sort of spectacular stunt or something that's extremely exciting, action oriented, as he's pulling up to a hotel. Really?
Yes.
That's when you go to that theme.
It's a pretty
that's
exciting hotel.
I mean, it was. I thought it was just poorly laid out.
All right, in fairness, though, I'm on a watch through of Bonds right now. Rewatch From Russia with Love sometime, and they do the exact same thing when Bond goes to his hotel for the first time. It's playing like exciting James Bond music while he's like checking into his room. And I'm like, what the heck? It doesn't fit at all.
It was really very much like that. And From Russia with Love, it's glaringly obvious the level of sophistication that occurs between From Russia with Love and Goldfinger.
Yes.
In terms of the scores.
Score. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So what I wanted to say about the score for this, I love this movie. It's in my upper echelon of Bond films, but the score is a thing you could pick on. But the easy answer for it was if they had switched the opening title theme and the end title theme.
That would have made it better because
K.D. Lang. Because I don't mind aping John Barry when you get it right. K.D. Lang's Surrender is the quintessential Bond theme.
It's certainly better than Sheryl Crow's theme, which I don't remember. We had one time done an episode where we reviewed all the Bond music.
Oh,
I don't remember what I said. I don't remember what I said about this particular theme, but listening to it now, it was almost like nails on a chalkboard, quite frankly. Yeah, and no, I'm not talking about K.D. Lang.
It's not like Madonna or Garbage to me. But well,
Madonna's the worst one, but we'll get there.
Okay, as long as we've got that as a baseline.
And I've actually got it still on my playlist when I'm just cycling through music as something I listen to every now and then. I really enjoyed it. But I've always separated it from the movie because that theme didn't seem to get used throughout the movie like you see in other movies.
And that's where the K.D. Lang piece, which is, you know, I mean, I've always wanted to be like in a meeting at work and make some pronouncement and have the horns go, wah, wah, wah. You know, I just thought I'd have more impact if that happened.
The thing is, I think
her song, K.D. Lang's song, when I heard it, it's on my regular playlist in my car. It's really good.
I think they didn't make that the prime theme purely because they didn't want K.D. Lang being the representative of James Bond. And they preferred Sheryl Crow, who was more sexy in her presentation.
Probably true. But it was the wrong choice.
It was the wrong choice. I totally agree. But I think that was their thought process. So let's kind of cycle through the. Well, first of all, I also thought I'm going to just
keep going for stream of consciousness a little bit. But I also read something where the script, this is one of these movies where the script was not finalized when they actually started filming, nor was Jonathan Pryce cast in the role yet. So that explains to me a little bit of why, despite the fact that he gave a really good performance, the character didn't really speak to me in you know, that threatening way that I feel like a James Bond villain should, because I don't think it was written for him.
I don't know if, I mean, listen, I have no reason to doubt that that's accurate. I just don't think that's any kind of excuse. I don't see the problems you see with it. But to me, when you're a late signing and a script not being done, Casablanca wasn't done when they started shooting.
Well, wasn't
this is no Casablanca.
But he's also not trying to shoot a laser at the moon or anything either. You know, it's a very different kind of big bad.
Anthony Hopkins supposed to be the bad guy initially?
Not sure. Possibly.
I think I'd read that somewhere. Now I'm going to have to go and look.
Yeah, no, I read that today. Yeah, you're right. Again, that's on Wikipedia, and, but yes.
Must be true.
I'll say Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce were probably comparable in their ability to put the performance together. I think it really comes down to how it's written. My criticism of Jonathan Pryce in this movie is not his performance so much as I just didn't feel he was written as well as he could have been.
Well, listen to this, though. And this is actually an IMDb trivia. It's the second item down. And it says Sir Anthony Hopkins was cast as Elliot Carver and joined the production, but walked after 3 days because it was so chaotic and there was no completed shooting script. I mean, that right there says everything, you know, just confirms all that, really.
And you know what? There are movies, and we've covered some on this show, where the script wasn't completed. You know, Jeff mentioned Casablanca. We never covered that on this show, but I can tell you The Fugitive, which I think it was a great movie, and I ranked it as Jaws, was not completed when they started filming. So it does happen. What's up, Scott?
I didn't realize, I knew nothing about this movie going into it other than it was the next, you know, the next one in our coverage. So I had never seen it before. So when Jonathan Pryce's name came up in the opening credits, I got pretty excited because I always remember him best as Mr. Dark in Something Wicked This Way Comes, where he scared the shit out of me when I was a little kid. So I was hoping for something scary from him, and yeah, I was frankly disappointed. I don't know what he was going for exactly. Was he supposed to be Ted Turner? Was he supposed to be just?
Ted Turner.
Yeah,
Murdoch wasn't the name then.
No, yeah, I thought it was Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, but yeah, I found him more goofy than anything else, and I don't know if that's what he was going for. I don't really know, but
I think he was going for kind of like that sly, so overconfident that he found everything humorous in his own way. I don't think he was trying for goofy, but I think of, like, you know, looking back on other Bond movies, and I'm trying to think a Bond villain who certainly would not be a physical match for Bond, but you feel the seething in him and everything, and he is threatening in his own way, was, and he's not nearly the actor Jonathan Pryce was, Gert Frobe in Goldfinger.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted from Jonathan Pryce's character. I wanted that feeling of threat.
Where here it was more like Ted Turner crossed with Steve Jobs.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, Steve. I definitely got a Steve Jobs vibe.
With a big sloppy guy wandering around in the background.
Yep.
So, and then, you know,
it's like Cousin Eddie moved in.
We keep comparing them. You know, possibly the best henchman ever in Goldfinger against one of the worst ones, I think, in Stamper.
I will agree with you. I will agree with you there. Stamper is a big old white bread slab of nothing.
Stamper was absolutely reflective, and it's one of the biggest things in this movie that is absolutely reflective of the time in which it was made.
He looked like he should have walked off the set of Children of the Corn.
I actually looked like, I thought he was like probably Billy Idol's stand-in.
Yeah. Yeah, except more buff, I guess.
Yeah.
But he didn't have that immediate feeling of threat. I was never like when he walked onto the seat onto the screen, I was like, Stamper.
Dr. Kaufman was just as bad for me. That's one of the things
I didn't like. I found him really? To be amusing.
Oh, because to me it looked like a sketch on the Carol Burnett show with like Harvey Korman in that role.
I didn't get that out of it. Chiavelli always, he's so weird anyway. Like anything he does is going to kind of work for me.
I'm the same way there with Chiavelli.
Yeah, I don't know. I get a kick out of him in everything I've ever seen him in, including this. And I was ready to forgive him as a secondary henchman who is not nearly as competent as he thinks he is. And I found his whole scene to be a little bit amusing. That was one of the few things that didn't bother me. And you know what? I'm overstating it when I say bothered me. It's not like I watched this and I said, oh, this was horrible.
No.
I just finished watching it and I thought, you know what? I forgot about the last time I saw it. And a week from now, I'm going to forget about this all again. That's what it feels like to me.
I don't know. It's only the second one that I saw in the theater, so that might be part of the reason why.
That there's no way to listen. As much as I like the movie, there's no way to escape the impact of if it's the second one you saw in the theater, man. That's not. You don't have to be rough on yourself about it. That's just how.
Oh no, I'm not. I'm just trying. Like I've said, though, I still think it's prescient. But even as a teenager, I walking in there and seeing it. I was blown away. Plus, I mean, the Hong Kong thing, I mean, that's, you know, it's not an elephant in the room. It was a big part of the marketing for the movie.
Absolutely. James Bond movies follow trends.
Yeah.
They are not trendsetters the way you hope they are. They follow trends. And if you look at a lot of the movies that came out and they have like these different themes that go on in them, and then you look at what came out in the year before them or 2 years before them, and you start seeing, okay, that's the trend they're following here.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, I'm kind of a mark for, you know, the Hong Kong action stuff. So you're going to get one of the big names at the time in this, and she's going to be doing action, and she's not just going to be a pincushion for Bond. And like, and not that I have a problem with those characters either. I mean, part of the reason I watch them is I want the sex and violence, and that's part of the reason why I'm there. But again, you're going to give Bond kind of an equal. And she, I mean, the stuff that she's doing with her own gadgets, and she's got her own safe house, and she's ready to go start kicking ass. I mean, the motorcycle chase, I mean, like, I could still, I didn't even have to rewatch this to be able to talk about this, because I feel like I know it like the back of my hand.
Oh, yeah. I haven't watched this movie in 2 years, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely resonated with me, and it still does. Like, I'll probably... You know, I get home a couple hours before my wife does, so tomorrow I probably will throw this one on since we're talking about it now.
Well, you know, I've often said on, you know, on this show and other shows that we do, that I don't criticize anybody for being more enamored with something than I am. That's never the issue.
You know, you have to understand, I'm not saying I didn't like it. I'm just saying in the scale of Bond movies, it's not as high up. Yeah. But I still liked it.
And I mean, I'm sure part of it's the age thing too. Like, I didn't get the golden age.
What do you mean?
You're about 10 years older than me, right?
Probably at least.
Yeah. So I mean, the ones that
Chris
I mean,
is 25.
I wish. If only. I mean, so the ones that I was seeing on cable on a loop all the time were the Connery ones. Not the Connery ones, the Roger Moore ones, which is why I love the Roger Moore ones. And then I didn't see the Dalton ones until they hit VHS. So the first theater ones for me were the Brosnan ones. So I'm sure if, you know, when you were probably the age that I started watching them, when you started watching them, you were getting the reruns of the Connery stuff. So it's just like... It's kind of amazing, though. What are we, almost 60 years into this franchise now? And we got guys of all different ages here talking about
this. This is where it's getting disturbing.
Right?
I saw Goldfinger at the drive-thru.
Drive-in. Drive-thru.
Yeah, the drive-in. I saw it at the drive-in with my parents. It was a double feature with a re-release of Dr. No.
Oh, that's great.
My first movie review, Car All Broken. I've been seeing the Bond movies that long, and I started opening day on Spidey Love Me going either by myself or with my friends. I was 12 years old. And so I've been going to Bond movies a freaking long time.
Well, so, you know, we're in the same club there. I'll tell you something that did bother me in this movie. Like when it happened, I really thought I actively don't like that they did this. I never minded when they would use Desmond Llewellyn for some comic relief. I didn't like in this movie that they made him look like a buffoon, that he couldn't even handle his own gadget. That bothered me.
That is definitely something.
I absolutely accept that. The redeeming feature at the same time as he was in an Avis uniform, and that was my first career. Was I? So.
I didn't like that he couldn't handle the remote car, and yet Bond just went up and did it. I don't mind
if Bond handles it better. I don't mind that, but the fact that he had trouble with it—that was stupid.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you 100%. If he had said, here, let me show you how to do it, and he's kind of slowly going through the paces, and Bond says, well, let me try, and then he just, you know, hits the gas and goes, I'm cool with that. Yeah. But when he starts, you know, hitting into the wall and whatever, it's like, no, that should not happen.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Let's talk Bond women here.
Let's talk them.
Terry Hatcher, I quite frankly, even though she is real and spectacular, I thought she was kind of wasted in this movie. I didn't like the way she was used. Now, this is like at a point where her career was kind of a little bit of a downturn, because I think Lois and Clark had been canceled already. And she's trying to revive her career here. But, you know, she got the part of the Bond woman who dies quickly, and they really didn't make much use of her.
I think she's at the upper echelons, at the upper limits of her talent in this movie. And I say this as a deeply affectionate fan of Tango and Cash, which is coarse quality cinema. I really think that she actually did a yeoman-like job with that character who you know is going to die.
I don't disagree. I just feel like she was a little wasted, and I don't think you had to give her anything to really stretch her acting chops. But I think she could have been better used in this movie.
But how many of the secondary Bond women really get a chance to shine anyway?
I'm going to keep going to Goldfinger. And was it Dink?
She got a chance to shine, you're saying, Paul? Come on.
She was appealing and had a good moment. Whereas I don't think Terry Hatcher really had a good moment in this. And even her outfit, you know, and I'm not much into criticizing outfits, but that feathery thing she had on, it was like, get that thing away from me. It's so itchy.
But she is pregnant. Do you think she was going to let herself be? At the time, she was pregnant. She's visibly pregnant. And I'm not complaining. I mean, she's filled out. She looks great. But again, I've never been a pregnant woman, nor will I ever be a pregnant woman. I would imagine I'd be like, put me in something comfortable if I'm going to be under these goddamn lights all day.
She had one great line.
With a gun under your pillow.
She said, was it something I said? And she says, I'll be right back.
That was cold.
Yeah, she was fingers on the chalkboard for me. I mean, I liked her in Lois and Clark and Star Trek, other things that she did. But she was, I just... did not like anything that she did in this movie. I was waiting for her scenes to end.
I was waiting for her to do something that I found interesting.
Now, I did like the fact that they brought in history of Bond, where that this was someone from his past, which they didn't do with women often.
Yeah, it was kind of a Captain Kirk move.
Yeah. that M sit there and basically forced him to get on her in this one.
Pump her for information.
Yep.
Now, all that said, I think Michelle Yeoh was excellent casting.
Yeah.
Did an excellent job. I think they did good to not really try and emphasize any type of romantic relationship between them. They skirted it, but they didn't really push it at any point. And I don't think it was necessary.
It wasn't. Because she's not, it's not the Spy Who Loved Me. She is there, the Chinese government. She has a job to do. She wants to get the job done. It's, you know, it's pretty matter of fact in that respect. I mean, especially with the big end game, and this is, let's force a war to happen so I can sell more papers. there's really not a lot of, no time for love, Dr. Jones.
One of the things that I like about it is she has been, you know, she'd been in the Hong Kong films, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is our first chance to see that she's really a good actress too.
Yeah.
And this is actually just the start of her being a good actress.
I think the plan was, much like they had the plans with Halle Berry as Jinx, that they were going to break her off into her own movies in the same character. But obviously that never happened.
But at least with Michelle Yeoh, that thought, as far as we know, didn't come up until after the movie was out and people responded to it, where they were trying to manufacture that for Halle Berry.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly true. And I think in the right climate, I think a Michelle Yeoh starring vehicle as that character would have a chance of being very good.
Well,
I don't know if she's an Oscar winner now, right? Yeah,
I don't
know if it would make the huge money that it should, but I think it would have a chance of being very good. Who else do we have in here? Gupta, Ricky Jay.
All right. Explain that one to me.
Yeah,
he was a wasted character, quite frankly.
Okay.
But I think
a good actor with a wasted character. And why was he Mr. Gupta?
I think Hiro hit it on the head that he's basically Wozniak.
That wasn't me that said that.
I just don't get why he had an Indian surname.
Yeah, that's. I'm guessing that they had somebody else in mind for the role.
And this is the age we live in now, where I would like do find and replace on the name, dude. that's mystified me since the first time I saw it, and you know, it's like that's an Indian surname.
I got it. I'll no prize it for you. He was adopted by Indian parents in America.
There you go.
Boom. There you go.
We got it. All right.
Problem solved.
Yep. And then I guess the last one I have a comment on is I kind of like Joe Don Baker, but I prefer Felix Leiter.
Everybody does, but we weren't getting him again. And I like him in this too. I mean, he's one of those guys. He pops up. He's always good in everything he's in. You know, he kind of plays the same guy every time in everything he's in, but it's one of those familiar things. At least they got the same contact back again, played by the same actor. You know, a little bit of continuity goes a long way.
Yeah.
I like the casting of Admiral Roebuck as Jeffrey Palmer, who actually played on a TV show with Judy Dench.
As time goes by.
Yeah, for a long time. I think it was 12, 13 years.
Something like that.
Wow.
And they're phenomenal shift in their chemistry from what they do on that show. Mm-hmm. To their very, very professional. I mean, you know, we haven't talked about Judy Dench because she's freaking great in
everything. Yeah, she is.
It really was, I think, pretty darn. They're. I don't think you call it banter because it wasn't lightweight.
No,
but their back and forth in a tense situation was really strong, I thought. Jeffrey Palmer was also on Fall and Rise original Perrin, where he played his idiot brother-in-law in the early 70s, which is probably my favorite British sitcom.
I do love that show too.
Not the censored version you get today, if you ever can find it.
I like seeing Colin Salmon. I hope that's
yeah, that's yeah. name.
I like that actor. I've liked him ever since Resident Evil, and I'm looking here at his filmography, and it looks like he's in two more Bonds coming after this film. So hopefully he gets a little bit more to do and everything, because I don't really like that actor.
Yeah, spoilers. I don't think he does. Oh.
No, he doesn't. But I mean, he does show up. So
he's more or less her chief of staff, the Bill Tanner role.
But at least he's there. At least they kept him around. It's like, okay, this MI6 is the same, you know.
I think you know, as Jeff said, I think we got to just say that Judi Dench is awesome in the role, and it's funny how, and I feel like this gives her like a more of a three dimensional feel, how she can be antagonistic towards Bond directly, but she's protective of him to others.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think it's like
I can talk smack about my brother, but don't you start?
Exactly.
That's exactly the feel.
And you know, when they say, "What is he doing?" and she just says, "His job." And I mean, it's delivered perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, of the modern era ones, bringing her in GoldenEye, I mean, it signaled a shift which was unavoidable going into the early 90s. But man, she just sinks her teeth into that role. I mean, when you think of outside of, you know, the original M, she's the M that you think of.
Yeah.
Really.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did y'all even notice Gerard Butler was in the cast?
I did not.
He was the leading seaman aboard the HMS Devonshire.
Oh my God. Yes.
And the other guy, the other surprise in the credits was Pip Torrance, which if you saw Preacher, you now think of him as the ultimate Nazi character if anyone needs a Nazi.
Yeah.
Okay. Or you could just go, Mrs. Torrance.
Shut up, Danny. Oh, boy.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny that, you know, when they went to a younger Miss Moneypenny, when they got rid of Lois Maxwell, I just felt like that didn't do anything. Samantha Bond she's just there.
Yeah, but again, it's also the change in the times too. You think they're going to have the puppy love starstruck assistant now and have a play? Like,
it's you absolutely not, could.
Oh my gosh. Could. Okay. The Minister of Defense. The Minister of Defense is Julian Fellowes, the creator of Downton Abbey. See Samantha Bond.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, totally didn't recognize her from that. And I've watched all of Downton Abbey. Shh, don't tell anybody. I'll lose my cred. It's a really good show.
I made fun of it the first three episodes and I stopped. I loved it.
Yeah, it's good.
We did too. We watched the whole thing.
And just to surrender my man card, we watched the whole thing also, including the two movies.
Yeah,
I haven't seen the second movie yet, so
I've not even watched one episode.
It's one of those things. Like, I'm usually not big on the historical drama thing, but it's damn good TV.
And I thought I was remembering something on the HMS Bedford. The air war officer was Hugh Bonneville, who was Lord Grantham.
Oh wow! God. All right, I'll be keeping my eyes on that when I throw this on, so, you know, for work tomorrow.
How about that?
I didn't realize we had such a Downton Abbey connection.
And what's really funny, well, apparently it could be, who knows, maybe it's where Julian Fellowes met them.
Quite possibly.
And yeah, that's right. Hey, look, none of us actually put on Downton Abbey ourselves. It was all because there was a woman in our life, right?
That's how it started.
But I am the one who rewatches it.
Yeah, I don't think any of us objected once it went forward, though.
I got her with professional wrestling. She got me with Downton Abbey. What do you want? In the Crown. Like, okay,
fair.
So there you go.
Fair. So I thought the directing in the movie was adequate. I thought it was fine in the quiet scenes, nothing spectacular, but I thought the action scenes were very well directed.
Yeah, I can't fault the action in this. It's all staged really well. Like I said, that motorcycle chase where they're handcuffed, man, that is something that would have come right out of Hong Kong action cinema of the time.
And the fight scenes. The
Bond had that remote control car.
That was dope.
That was just awesome.
And you compare that to movies that have come out in the last 20 years, there would be so many more quick cuts in it. that it makes it harder to follow that action.
Right.
This, well, had, this had like, good listen, timing.
Not in, the in Hong Kong, they're putting it all in a proscenium because it's these actors doing this stuff. They don't have to cheat it. So you don't get the quick cuts. It's only in America when they've got actors that have to do action that can't
sure,
do it.
I mean, it comes out of the Jason Bourne movies where I'm just convinced that he doesn't know how to fight. Either that or they had the worst choreographers ever. Yeah, and then we see it in the car chase in the second Daniel Craig movie that opens the film, where they're shooting a car chase in medium close up, and I'm like, "Who do you think you are, Tony Scott?"
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in the good sense.
No, absolutely not. That movie is a prime example of the overly ambitious editor making too many quick cuts and too many close-ups without establishing shots.
Yeah, and you know, and we'll save some of the venom from when we do that movie.
Yeah.
But you know, when you build a hotel to explode, it's going to explode.
I thought the fight scenes in this were well done, and I did hear someone talking about this, and I did not see it, so I can't say it from personal experience. But somebody was talking about Michelle Yeoh doing her own stunts to it, you know, to a large extent, and they were comparing it and saying in such and such scene, and I don't even remember which one, I think it was when they were rappelling off the poster down the building, that you could see it was Michelle Yeoh and you could see that it was Pierce Brosnan's body double.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm surprised they got a bonding for that, though, because a lot of the times if it's an American or European production, they're not going to let the actors do that stuff.
The thing with that scene for me is that even in the theater, it gave me a Home Alone flashback. Because, you know, the scene in Home Alone where he's ziplining to his treehouse.
Yes.
And he has to keep, whoa. And Michelle Yeoh and Pierce Brosnan are doing the same thing, going down the sink because it takes too long.
If Brosnan had yelled up and said, "Come and get me your big horse's ass," I mean, instant A plus. That was fantastic.
That scene, though, that was one of the ones where, you know, I mean, it's almost an oxymoron, but it strained credibility to the point of, okay, they knew that they would be able to slide down this thing and that it would stop them at this point where they could swing in and break the window and come in, and it was just like, you know, I can accept so many things, but just how did they possibly plan that out in the 2 seconds they had until?
I'm going to counter that. If you can accept the car that turns into a submarine, them going down side of a building,
that's an invention as opposed to a planned maneuver. There's a difference to me.
And that's the crappiest glass on a skyscraper I've ever seen.
Yeah, even Bruce Willis had to shoot the window first.
Right. I was thinking that when I watched it, I kept waiting for when they were kicking back from the glass for him to pull out his gun and shoot it. And when they just broke through, I'm like, what kind of shitty office building glass is that?
And not
just
the slightest scratch on either of them.
I was going to make the joke, but you did it for me, Brian. Thank you.
It was Ho Chi Minh. It was Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam.
Yeah, those Chinese glazers just. Yeah.
So now answer a question for me. When he originally thinks he's parachuting into Chinese territory, right? They're not concerned about all the American markings, but when they're going into Vietnam, it's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get that. That's just real politic. Don't forget, when the movie comes out,
right,
we were still trying to reestablish diplomatic relationships with Vietnam.
I thought that came so much later. That's why.
And it was Clinton administration, and that's when this movie was out. And so it seems a little bit of a stretch, but that was actually of the period.
Yeah, makes sense.
And, yeah. And you know, thus far, we've never lost a war to China.
Not yet.
This is the first movie that they made after, what's his name, Albert Broccoli passed away.
Yes.
Do you think there was a difference in the production based upon that?
I don't know.
No.
It felt to me, and this could just be revisionist, you know, based on what I've heard since about them not having the script and all of that, it felt to me like it was less planned out than other Bond movies had been.
Oh, yeah.
It felt like it was more by the seat of their pants.
I absolutely, listen, despite the fact I love it and you don't, okay? I absolutely see some of the stuff you're saying. And I don't know that Broccoli being there or not being there, there's ebbs and flows throughout the movie. We talked about the difference in the movies, sorry, that we talked about the difference in sophistication between the score from Russia with Love, which they were playing the Bond theme like every 3 minutes, and Goldfinger, which has a luscious score, and mm-hmm. very and it's where we start seeing them doing different elements in different levels of tension and all that kind of stuff like that. You see the sophistications going up and down in the scripts all the way along. I mean, you know, we all had a robust discussion of License to Kill, but the script for that one's not as good as the ones on either side of it. You know, so I just took this as a natural flow. Later, I think we can say, because, you know, Broccoli's not involved in the development of it or anything. I think we can start seeing stuff going forward, but I think this one might be a bit quick.
Fair enough.
That's my 2 cents. Long-winded as it might be.
Well worth the 2 cents we paid.
Yeah.
I guess before we rate this, anybody else have any other significant points to bring up?
Yeah, something I noticed. So I don't know how you guys watch this movie. You know, I don't know, you know, what you might remember from the theater, or, you know, what your setups may be at home if you rewatched it for this recording. But this was my first time watching it. So, you know, somebody had said early on that, you know, they were a little annoyed they couldn't find this streaming, you know, on one of the platforms we already pay for, that it was, you know, you had to pay for it. So I wanted to watch it, you know, in HD and all that sort of thing. But because I had to pay, I was like, nope, not going to do that. So I already have it on DVD. I've never seen it. So I put the DVD in. Now, my setup, because it's projected large and everything, DVDs, you know, the lack of resolution definitely shows. So I was paying more attention to the sound, because the sound sounded really spectacular. Even though it was off DVD, I was very impressed with the sound mix and the sound quality. So, you know, the score sounded great. The special effects the sound effects sounded great. Everything's going right along. And I wish I'd written it down exactly when this happened, because I think it happened a couple of times. But I think the first time, if I'm not mistaken, it was during the part where he's breaking into the building through the roof, whatever. I think it was the Carver building or something.
Yeah.
So there's all these fights going on and everything. And as I say, I was really impressed with the sound and, you know, the sound design and all that. And then all of a sudden there's a part where Bond is squaring off with a guy, and it's like they pulled the fight, you know, the fist impact sounds from like an old episode of Gunsmoke or something. And all of a sudden it was psh, psh, psh. And, you know, my problem with Pierce Brosnan at the end of the day is I already think he's a pretty boy that I don't really buy as an ass-kicking secret agent. So then when all of a sudden it goes from these awesome, you know, modern day Hollywood sound effects to psh, it's like he hits like a pansy, and it really took me out of that portion of the movie. But I'm just wondering, did anybody else notice this? Because it was really weird, because you're in full surround, but then those couple of hit impacts were completely mono and like right in the middle of the room. So, I mean, it was extremely noticeable to me. Did anybody else notice this?
I now have to go back and
watch this.
Yeah, yeah. You have to hear it. Yeah, it's really bad. I mean, in what otherwise is a spectacular sound mix, that really stood out to me. It was just really a bizarre sound choice in those moments. And it happened a couple of times during the movie, but it was specifically with fight sound effects. It was like they just pulled too old a file or something. It was really weird. Like no bass to it. You know, and I've become used to, you know, in modern movies, ever since Raiders of the Lost Ark, everything, when somebody gets hit, it's like, you know, it's like somebody dropped a side of beef on the floor. You know, everything's got this wicked impact to it. And all of a sudden it was, like I say, it was like from an old TV show or something. It was just this hollow, no bass, no reverberation. It was just psh, psh, psh. And I was like, no, that doesn't work, man. You know, it was bad.
So you're saying you're all about the bass, about the bass, about the bass.
Well, yeah.
I mean, was he supposed to, was he being stealthy? Maybe that was just an artistic choice. He can't make a lot of noise. I can't remember the scene right off the top of my head.
Yeah, but no, I don't think so. In those particular moments, I don't think so. Because I think there was gunplay.
Was that the fight on the printing press where it throws the guy into, they'll print anything?
Right around that section of the movie, yeah.
And that's the other thing I just want to, before we do go to it, is I mentioned at the beginning, and I want to mention again, I do think the premise of the power of the press and what they can do and how they can manipulate world events around the press, it is kind of frightening when you look at the way partisan news is presented today. And I don't care which side of the aisle you're on. You can't deny that exists.
Well, we could, but we'd be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, that's one of the reasons why I found this more disappointing, because I think it's such a powerful topic and so ripe to be, you know, exploited, you know, then and now. That it's disappointing, you know, that they couldn't do a little bit more with it for me.
But were we really going to get a hard-nosed, gritty take on that at the time in the Bond franchise?
I don't know if it had to be hard-nosed. I think it just needed to be a little bit more scary.
This is a really good discussion. And I say this as somebody who loves the movie. There is a better movie to be had in this. And the truth is, it might be a better movie if it's not a Bond movie.
There you go.
Yeah. And there's points in this movie where it almost feels like it's not a Bond movie. And I think
you know what I'm saying about this, though? About you could afford to have more of an edge and more of a dystopic resolution to this movie if it wasn't a Bond film that had to come out a certain way.
True, yeah. The Bond film has to have him being successful at stopping whatever it is that's going on. And maybe it would have been a more... I don't want to say entertaining because it would be bothersome almost, but maybe it would be a more deeply felt movie if at the end everything he did was wasting his time because he couldn't stop the power of the what do they call the press, the fourth estate or something along those lines?
Fourth estate. Actually, you hit on something there, because the whole the crux of the movie was, you know, media manipulation by this guy Carver for his own, you know, gain. And then at the very end, after he's killed, M manipulates the media by providing him a whole bunch of false information for their game.
Yeah, and if they had maybe emphasized, you know what, in your own way, you're just as bad for doing that.
Yeah.
That would have been a little bit, you know, a very thoughtful ending, you know, a little disturbing, but thoughtful.
And you did get a little bit of art imitating life with Robert Maxwell, the publisher who bought the Daily News, who died on his yacht. I don't know if they ever found him. But I believe he died on the yacht.
So, you know, what's interesting is to see how this has been, the invasion of privacy and media manipulation has been handled in other places. If you go back to the Rockford Files in the 70s, the house on Willis Avenue, the two-parter that is talking about data collection and things like that, and even ends with an actual factual thing about what was being done in the 70s. And then you go up to Person of Interest about rampant AI in more recent times and within the last decade. And you see that this topic is not something that's going to go away. So it's something that could be boldly revisited.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it's not.
you know, if you think about the overall plot, it has a slight, I mean, the difference is here he's looking to make money by starting a war. Whereas in You Only Live Twice, it was to start a war so we can emerge and take over what's left.
Yeah. Which that is the overarching theme in a lot of them. I mean, in Spy Who Loved Me, he wants to kill all life on land so that he could start life in, you know, in the ocean and be the leader of that world.
And then the next movie you get Hugo Drax doing it.
Yeah. So I mean that is not an uncommon theme.
But that was better because that was my first Bond movie in the theater.
I'm curious though. I'll profess to be just a little bit lost by his motivations though, because you know, this wasn't just simply starting a war. He was trying to ignite World War III. How the hell do you benefit from that?
He wasn't going to ignite World War III because he had the deal. He was going to wipe out the Chinese leadership, and General Chiang was going to, you know, work out a peace deal and get the Nobel Peace Prize, and he was going to get rights to the media in China for 100 years.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that was going to happen.
Okay. I was just reading how Monica Bellucci actually read for Paris Carver.
Oh, wow.
And can you just imagine how different that would have been if it had been her?
Actually, it was Jim Belushi.
Later, Inspector.
Yeah.
Did somebody say who's she?
No, I said imagine if it was Jim Belushi reading for the book.
Now imagine if it was John, because that would be a miracle.
Okay, so now I'm thinking it's time to give our ratings on this. And I'm going to say, as I've said on so many occasions, even what I think is lowercase Bond is still entertaining. So to me, and I know Dave disagrees with me on this because we had it in one movie, but to me there is no Jaws 4 Bond movie. But if I look to the ones that were the most disappointing to me, for the most part, it was because there wasn't enough spectacle in it, or the story just seemed to not go anywhere. In this one, there was spectacle. I just felt like the parts that they put together didn't fit quite right. And it made for a forgetful story, despite the fact that it had a great premise. So, unfortunately, I got to put it at a Jaws 3 for me. And I don't like putting Bond at Jaws 3. It's not a bad movie. I just don't think it lived up to what it could have been. We'll work our way around. Dave, you'd be next.
While I said this is not my favorite, I don't dislike the movie. I think it has a lot of positives. It's got a few things that I would have made different choices. But by all means, I don't hate this movie. At least it's not as much as you do. I would give this a low-end Jaws 2. Because overall, I did enjoy it. I just would have tweaked it slightly, if I were making the film.
All right, Scott, you are now in the third seat.
This is a classic example of I wish there were actually five Jaws movies, because then I would feel much more comfortable putting it at Jaws 3, because I think it's right there in the middle of the pack. I enjoyed it while I was watching it. I don't think it's great, but I definitely didn't think it was a horrible movie. But going at, you know, with the scale as it exists, I'd have to lean a little bit more Jaws 2 than Jaws 3, because Jaws 3 for me, I don't know, you're leaning more towards, it wasn't really great, you know, it wasn't really that great of a movie, or I probably won't watch it again, or something. And I didn't feel that way about it. I mean, you know, there were some things I genuinely liked about it. I didn't really feel like we spent a lot of time on the positives. the whole thing where Bond's laying in the back seat of his car and driving it by remote. I love that whole scene. I thought that was cool as hell. And, you know, it probably seemed very science fiction at the time, but that seems pretty doable today. I thought that was neat. The bike chase was really cool, although I thought the cinematography was a little bit strange on some of that. Some of it looked a little fake when they were in the close-ups and all, but when they were doing the long shots, I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, overall, it's a good action movie. I enjoyed it for the action aspect, but, you know, Paul, you hit on something where it's almost like it is just an action movie and not necessarily a Bond movie. And I think that was a good observation, because I kind of approached it more that way. Like, you know, this could have easily been like one of the Mission Impossible movies or something. You know, it just kind of fits in that same type of thing. It didn't feel necessarily like a Bond. I think that's its biggest problem, but I mean, I enjoyed it. So yeah, I'll say like Dave said, a low end Jaws 2. Again, you know, if there was a Jaws 2.5, then I think that would be the perfect rating for this, because it's right in the middle of the pack for me.
All right, Chris.
I'm going to go high Jaws 2 on this. You know, my Jaws ratings are going to be for, there's not a lot of, in terms of everything that gets talked about, there's not a lot of Jaws out there. So as much as I do really enjoy this one, and I still fondly recall my experience in the theater seeing it, and I watch it probably every 2 or 3 years. Yeah, high Jaws 2. I really get a kick out of it. And again, it's one of those things like, what are you looking for? And I have no problem with a Bond movie being an action movie. I mean, I'm the guy that likes License to Kill a lot. And that's just
somebody.
Yeah, and that's just an 80s hit. Oh, right, we're going after cocaine dealers. Let's go. But again, that's right up my alley. This is much more of a film with some more meat on it than that is. But yeah, I have no problem giving it a high Jaws 2. And if you haven't seen it, that's definitely worth your 2 hours.
All right, Brian.
Yeah, I got to agree with Hero there, because this is one that's got a lot of rewatchability for me. If it's showing on something when I'm changing, you know, looking around, I'm going to stop and watch. You know, but I'm not sitting there just wrapped with attention on it, though. So it's like, I can look away and do stuff because I know what's going on. But so, yeah, it's just a solid Jaws 2 for me.
All right, Jeff, you are betting last right now.
All right. I would say it is neither the Plan 9 for Outer Space for our generation. That, of course, was Batman and Robin. And neither is it Citizen Kane. Let's just land it at Jaws 2 and leave it that. I won't say upper or lower, because I think there are very, very, I think might have been Christopher said this, very few Jaws. But I like this movie. I think, like I said earlier, I think it's Brosnan's second best outing as Bond, followed closely by some horrific ones. I feel really comfortable with it. And in all seriousness, I don't think I've watched this in a year and a half. And I remember it very well. I think I maybe carried along a little more by the premise than you are disappointed by the lack of exploration in the premise. And I find those to be good reactions. So that's it. That's it for me.
Yeah, like Wolfen said, you know, again, I don't criticize anybody for having a different opinion than me. And the fact that you had your mileage may vary. Unfortunately, Sean wasn't able to make it with us tonight because of a prior commitment. But if all worked out right, he's going to have a soundbite that I'm going to put in for the audience to hear right now.
Hey, everyone. I apologize not being able to this particular recording. I was actually at the Madonna concerts, and coincidentally enough, she did play Die Another Day, so I was having a very much a James Bond moment at her concert with my wife. But I wanted to record something for this particular Bond movie, because I think this might be my favorite Pierce Brosnan Bond. And I loved him as James Bond. I think what really stood out for this one, though, was setting and Michelle Yao. Michelle Yao was absolutely incredible in this. What I really liked about her was she was this attempt to have this female agent who was very complimentary to Bond. And what I liked about her was she wasn't this carbon copy of James Bond. And there's a real big key there. She stood out as coming from a very unique background, having a unique fighting style, having a unique approach to spying. But I liked that she knew things like the secret weapons of Bond, you know, everything that was being crafted by Q. They had stolen that technology along the way and kind of reworked it. And, you know, even when he pulled out the watch at the one point in time, it goes, this looks familiar. And, you know, she referenced the fact that they'd made some improvements. I thought that was really cool, and the banter felt very natural. The stunt sequences in this one I liked. There were elements of it, yes, on the Brosnan ones in particular. There were sequences that, yeah, they get over the top, which is very James Bond. But there was also elements about it that felt grounded. I did love the motorcycle chase. That part was really cool. There was something, though, about the relationship and the chemistry between the two of them that really worked. Jonathan Pryce played a great villain because you just, from the beginning, wanted to see him get blown up or have something happen to him, which I think is really important with a Bond film. You have to feel that they're evil, but there's a thing in this very short time frame. You have to construct this neat, this like hatred as an audience member, like where I want something to happen to this guy. And that happened, and I think it was his cockiness as well as his evil plans that just kind of really rubbed you the wrong way. He played a great role in that. But this is an example of another Bond film that had great casting, great locations, and something that felt very, very fresh and unique, which is hard to do in a Bond film because there's a certain formula to these films, and I felt like this one did have enough to it that it stands out on its own and feels very unique. This one is a high Jaws 2 for me. And it's something that I would instantly recommend as maybe my starting point for Pierce Brosnan, for somebody who's like, hey, I only want to watch one film. I kind of want to know what he was like as Bond. I could hand this one to them and say, this is what made him a great Bond. And I felt like this film kind of encapsulated all that. It's why it's one of my favorites. This is one that if I'm doing a standalone, this would be the one that I would recommend to somebody.
Okay. So now that said, next time out, we're going to find whether or not the world is in fact. And hopefully we'll have our whole panel ready to take a look at that next Brosnan film, the penultimate Brosnan film.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait.
And we will see if we have, in fact, the worst Bond woman ever, or if that title would be taken by somebody else, because I think popular culture says it is the worst one ever.
I'll save my good comment about that till that show. I just want to thank you guys once again for including me in these Bond reflections. I have been a fan since I was a little kid. I know the difference between what I think is a good Bond movie and what I don't, but I love hearing your points of view on it, and I think it's a spectacular way to share our enthusiasm for the franchise.
Well, there's a reason that this crowd got put together, and I appreciate all of you making the time to come on and share your thoughts. And, you know, I've been a Bond lover about as long as you have, Jeff. You know, slightly later, even though I think we're right about the same age. But my first Bond experience was a double feature of Thunderball and You Only Live Twice.
Nice.
So, you know, we are contemporaries in that.
Yeah. Regard. Very nice. Hey, you had mentioned that you guys had done, before I joined, you guys had done a Bond music
focus. Yeah, I think I was on that one.
That was actually not on Is It Yours?
Oh,
that
okay.
That was on a Two True Freak show called Long Play. And on that show, they review, you know, it's different reviewers every time, and they take a classic album and review it. And we kind of turned that on its ear a little bit and said, we're going to do just Bond movies one by one and work our way through. And there is no question that Madonna was considered the worst of
that's great. That makes me feel so much better and less old.
If I can find the link for it, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, please. One thing I wanted to say is I think it would be fun as a pause on these things if we were to discuss the Bond themes that didn't make it.
Bring me that Alice Cooper.
And I mean, and, you know, Eric Clapton doing the Bond theme.
Mm-hmm.
Blondie with For Your Eyes Only. All sorts of great stuff like that. And then there's even some books that were created as James Bond properties that didn't become that. So there's a lot of fun to be had here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We're working our way through the movies. We have a lot left to still do with the finishing Brosnan and going through Craig, and who knows, by the time we get through Craig, we may have a new Bond already. There's still a lot to do, but when we're done with that, you know, I hate to break up the panel. I want to thank you guys for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Too late again, Mr. Bond. It's a bad habit of yours. There's nothing you can do.
T minus 2 minutes and counting.
The missile's fully programmed. It can't be stopped. In a matter of minutes, my plan will succeed. And thanks largely to your efforts, the British Navy will destroy the evidence. And I'll be out of here in a Carver News helicopter covering the event. It's going to be a fantastic show.
I may have some breaking news for you, Elliot.